You good? Okay. Hi, my name is Ellison. It is February 26, 2022 at 2:39 p.m. and I'm speaking with Tommy Fazell. We are in Fazell's home in Lynchburg, Virginia, and we'll be speaking about your time and involvement with the County of Roanoke's Pride Initiative throughout your life thus far. Can you please start by telling us your name and where you grew up?
My name is Tommy Fazell. I was born at Roanoke Memorial Hospital on June the 20th of 1961. I spent my childhood at 49 Ward Street, Salem, Virginia. We became Salem in 1968. We woke up on New Year's Day, and the city of Salem was our boundaries on the edge of our yard, and the city of Roanoke was now across the street. So we had to change our schools. All of my childhood friends got sent to other schools, etc., etc. The first year I started school was the first year of integration for the school system. I met my very first black children in first grade, Rochevious and Peggy Nance. I'd never seen a black child before. I grew up in a different era. I grew up in an era when black people rode on the back of the bus. I grew up in an era when the old Mill and Roads department store downtown had one bathroom in the basement for all black men, women, and children, while the whites had a lovely set of bathrooms up on the fifth or sixth floor. It was the top floor where the tea room was, where there was an attendant to wait on you. So it was quite a different world. So what else would you like to know, madam?
Did you have any siblings growing up?
I had an older sister, Mary Jo. Mary Jo was beautiful, smart as a whip, and normal. I was 6 years younger, buck-toothed, mouthy, and very artistic. My parents were scared to death.
So would you almost say that you were like the black sheep of your family, as people call it?
The oddball. I will not say black sheep, but I will say oddball. When I was 5 years old at Christmas, I was precocious, I'd already learned to read. I asked my mother for an illustrated history of fashion that I saw on the mezzanine at Hieronymus department store downtown Roanoke, where the books were. Mama bought me the book. On Christmas morning at my grandparents', while all of my butch little boy cousins went around with their trucks and G.I. Joes and had little gunfights and were acting masculine, I was waltzing around with my little fashion book open, pointing to a picture of Marie Antoinette, going, "Panier means basket hoop." Needless to say, my mother and father were horrified. That is the morning that my grandmother turned to my mother and said, "Joanne, honey, you've got a queer on your hands." My mother cried the rest of the day in the back guest bedroom.
So your parents knew kind of that you were gay ever since you were a child?
Yes, most definitely. I was what is called effeminate. I had large eyes, long lashes, red lips, and got a lot of looks from older men that I didn't understand until many years later.
So Salem is a particularly rural area. How was that like growing up within kind of that environment?
It was brutal. Salem is very much a town of the haves and the have-nots. My family didn't have a dime. We were shunned. We were made fun of. We wore hand-me-downs. My sister was brilliant and precocious, but very quiet. Her feelings got hurt easily. I was mouthy. So when the kids would call us poor white or white trash, I would say wonderful phrases to them like, "Your mother's a whore." That always started fights. I always came home with bloody lips, but I never gave in. I mean, if you called me a name, I'd just tongue lash you. Daddy said I had more balls than brains.
So what did your parents do when you were a child?
My father was a machinist for the Norfolk and Western Railway for 40-some years. My mother was a secretary at a church. She had to later on give up the position when she became ill with cancer. She was also the librarian at the church. I was raised in a very, very, very religious background. We were strict Presbyterian. We did not drink. We did not smoke. We did not play cards. And sex was strictly for procreation. And being queer was beyond. You would burn in hell instantly. Leviticus was quoted quite often in my household.
So how do you think growing up in a religious household kind of shaped who you were and who you are now?
People won't believe me when I say this, but it gave me courage. I was raised that I was one of the elect. I was Presbyterian, so I didn't care if I was a screaming faggot. I was still going to heaven. And I never drank. I never did drugs. I mean, my mother gave me a lot of moral backbone. And later on, like when I was fag-bashed later in college, it gave me the guts to keep my head up and keep rolling right on. Now, from my father, he was a redneck. Daddy's attitude was, if you're not invited to the party, then it's not a party. This gave me a lot of courage when I was snubbed and made fun of and all. I would just stick my chin in the air and say, screw you, and go on. I mean, that was the redneck in me.
So with your parents knowing kind of at a young age that you were queer and kind of gay at the time and potentially growing up to come out later in life, how did that affect your relationship with your parents? Were they always supportive?
Like I've told you earlier, when I was 16, my father wanted to have me lobotomized at the VA. Daddy was a World War II vet. He could get me in there. He said, quote, we're going to fix your wiring. I mean, being queer was not an option. I think he would have been cool if I had been butch and screwed girls and did guys on the side quietly. Later on in life, I found out that was something a lot of men did. As long as you had a wife and kids but kept your mouth shut, it was just playing with the guys. You know, it wasn't gay. It was just, you know, doing some guy stuff. It took my parents a long time. I don't think they ever fully accepted, but they tried to love me, and they tried to protect me. They thought I would burn in hell, but, you know, they kept that to themselves after a certain time because I was so mouthy. They were always gracious to my gay friends. They were always gracious to the men I dated. Daddy would just always call them my buds. I mean, Daddy had gay friends and didn't know it. I can think of one couple in particular that were together for 40 years, and Daddy just thought they were buds, and they've had a home together, a life together, they traveled together, and Daddy never, ever thought anything of it, because they were both butch. If you were butch and had played sports, you could get away with murder.
So at what age did you officially come out to your parents and kind of out to the public, or if that was at two separate times?
Two separate times, dear. I told my parents I thought I was gay when I was 15. Oh, I knew I was gay, but I mean, I knew when I was 8 years old and started having sex with my cousins, but we'll go into that later. I told my parents when I was 15, and my mother instantly put me into counseling with my pastor, who didn't know what the hell to do. So he called in a man from California that had grown up in my church and had moved to California and become a minister in the MCC movement. And this guy flew into Roanoke and met with me, talked to me, and then told my pastor he's queer. He goes, and he's gonna live a queer life. You know, y'all just better get ready. So.
Yeah, and you had talked about your cousins a little bit. What was the dynamic with that in particular?
My cousins were butch, honey, so they didn't get in trouble. I always got in trouble, but my cousins were butch, so, you know, nothing was ever said to them. I was the little queen, or the little queer, or the little cocksucker. So, you know, but I was a virgin. I would say all we did was just fool around. I mean, I didn't get into man-to-man action until I was in college. But I mean, yeah, I fooled around with my cousins, but, you know, we didn't think that much of it. But I did have older cousins that wanted to take me away to the family cabin on the weekend, and my mother wouldn't let them. And my father told my mother, Joanne, let them take him up there and make a man out of him. So I think Daddy knew damn well what was going on, but he didn't care because we were all related. He said, as long as it's blood, it's okay. So do not ask me any questions about incest. I will not answer them. So anyway.
I totally understand.
Yes. So anyway, and not between me and Daddy, please. Don't think that, but there's a lot going on with the cousins. So anyway, I didn't start to have real stuff until I was older. But I fooled around when I was a kid with my cousins. All kids do, I think. I don't know.
Probably.
I mean, my husband thinks it's perverted, so we won't go into details. But
definitely. So you came out to your parents, tried to come out, and when you were 15, so you were right around the age of middle high school. How was that age and like period for you?
Bad. Bad. High school was bad. I was not officially out, but you could look at me and tell I was queer. I wore vintage clothing. This was not a done thing in Salem. And I would buy and wear vintage clothing and overcoats and ties to school every day and wingtip shoes and shit like that. And later on, I found out I was called the gay godfather of Salem High School after I graduated, the kids that came after me, because I was regarded as one of the first out gays, even though I didn't think I was out. I had incidents where football players would, like, push me into my locker and stroke me and, you know, shit like that. And I would push and run because I was terrified. I didn't want, you know, I was kind of, I liked the attention, but I didn't want to get the shit beat out of me, and I didn't trust any of them, so I ran. I had teachers pick on me because they thought I was queer. It was not pretty. I would never, ever wish my high school years on any kid, because it was rough. If I had not been a strong individual, I would have buckled. There were gay kids that dropped out of school when I was going through high school that couldn't take pressure. But I said, screw you, I'm getting my education, and I kept going to school. Now, my parents did have to get me a car because I started to get roughed up on the school bus. And so they got me a car so I could be safe going to and from school.
What do you think really gave you the strength to keep persevering through high school?
I'm half redneck. I was bullheaded. I would be damned if I'd let anybody run my ass into the ground. I mean, I was going to get my degree and I was going to be somebody and you could go die. I mean, I always had a mouth on me and I was always determined and I wouldn't let anybody ram me into the damn ground. That was the redneck in me. I mean, you just, you know, you might be able to tell me off and you might be able to beat the shit out of me, but you weren't going to kill me and you weren't going to break my spirit. I mean, I was me. Screw you. I was wearing my British tweed overcoats to school every day and my ties, and if you didn't like it, you could go die. No, you'd probably beat the shit out of me first, but still, at the end of the, I might have a busted lip and a busted nose, but my head was up. Nobody was going to knock me into the ground. Uh-uh. No.
Absolutely. Do you have any memories from high school that you were particularly fond of that you can look back on, kind of pulling from away from the dark times? Were there any times that you look back on and you're just, your heart's full?
The only thing I can tell you that I thoroughly enjoyed was when I was 15, maybe 16, this was the late 70s, the Park, the gay club, the big gay club, opened in downtown Roanoke. I had three fake IDs. Back in those days, an ID had a paper part to it. You had your photograph from the DMV and then the paper part. If you were smart, you could take the paper part out and make copies of it on the copy machine in the library, and then you dipped it in green food dye, and it would make it green like the legal paper. If you knew how to take an X-Acto knife, you could cut numbers out and paste them on top of your legal birthday. So I had a fake ID for 18, a fake ID for 21. I can't remember the other age. So I grew hair very fast as a young man. I started shaving in middle school. So in the summers, I would grow a mustache and get a little bit of a tan, and I'd hit the clubs with a fake ID. So when the Park opened, now, I had been going illegally to Murphy's, which is a long-gone club that was in downtown Roanoke. It was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Murphy. They were from West Virginia. During the daytime, it was a luncheon establishment for doctors, lawyers, and professional people in downtown Roanoke. At night, after 10 o'clock, it was a different story. They had a DJ. They had a tiny dance floor. If Papa and Mama Murphy knew you, they'd let you in. Their sons were gay, so they knew about gay people. You were not allowed to close dance, but you could dance, you know, you could dance with somebody, but you couldn't touch them. There was no drag allowed in there. You could never, ever admit you were gay because that was against the liquor law of Virginia. You were not allowed to serve a known homosexual liquor or you could lose your liquor license, which Papa Murphy highlighted it with yellow and put it at the front door. So if the vice squad ever said anything, you're like, oh, hell no, I'm straight. I don't know who these fruits are. You know, that sort of thing. So Papa and Mama Murphy watched out for me. They knew that I was underage. They knew, but they never said anything. And me and my best friend Billy, we were known as the Dr. Pepper twins because we didn't drink. We drank Dr. Pepper. And the Murphys watched out for us. And that was what I enjoyed, because here by day, I was at school being this prim, white-bred little queen, you know, getting a snot beat out of me, but wearing my little outfits and all. But at night, I got to put on my tight Britannical jeans, and I'd roll downtown with Billy, and we'd go to Murphy's. I had a lot of fun. I was wearing vintage stuff like velvet smoking jackets. I mean, this was unheard of in Roanoke. Unheard of. And I was, you know, doing vintage shit and British punk looks. And it was a lot of fun. I hated high school. And I hated most of the kids there. But at night, I could be me. And I would go down there. And it was perfectly innocent. There was no sex or anything going on. It was just dressing up and having fun and knowing that you were among people that didn't look down on you because you were a fruit. So, the only good memory I have of high school with my peers, I would say there were three or four girls that liked me, that I hung out with. And one of them's mother was the Charleston champion of Roanoke. She had won the title back in the 40s or 50s, and she taught me to Charleston. I enjoyed the proms because I'd always wear tails, and I was a very good dancer. I had a lovely time at the proms. I had a wonderful voice, so I was in an elite singing group that the director was a horrible homophobe and used to give me shit. But I stayed in the group because we went on tour. I was at All-State Choir. And my favorite memory of that is we sang... they did the Waltz of the Flowers, and we all dressed as flowers. And, of course, being gay, I was determined to outdo everybody. And I cut out a tulip head of bright yellow construction board that was at least 3 feet off the top of my head. And I went to Stritsky's Forest and got green floral paper and made a huge bow tie. And was you could see me for 10 miles on the back of the riser. I mean, my head piece was like... pure drag. I mean, and I didn't know what drag was, but God, it was for days. It made the yearbook. I was in the yearbook with that outfit on. Jesus. And I was chosen to dance the waltz with a young lady, a delightful young lady. So the picture is she's in her ball gown and she looks very white, red, and pure. And here I am, this buck-tooth queen with Donny Osmond haircut and the biggest headdress on you've ever seen of a tulip. It was a sunflower. That was it. Had tons of points on it. It was a sunflower. Oh, that was awful. And it was tacky as hell. And I mean, but it was fabulous. So.
That's awesome. That's amazing. So you had briefly talked about the liquor law. I had not really known. Do you know when that changed?
You could not. It was a state law of Virginia, baby. You could not serve a known homosexual liquor or you'd lose your liquor license. So gay bars were... all right, let me give you a little bit of history that I don't know if anybody has talked about in your interviews. When I started going to the bars illegally, it would have been the later 70s. You had The Last Straw, which was on Salem Avenue. I don't know if you've heard of The Last Straw. They probably have ads in the pink pages, but there was The Last Straw. That was real cruisy. That was as a pool table and older men, and it was dark, and it was real cruisy, and it was a real tight-knit little group there. Those men took care of each other like brothers. And that was where the Rogues Levi Leather Club was. They hung out there. That was where they started. And I knew a lot of the founders, like Lee Cruz was a dear friend. He was a founder. Okay, then you had the Horoscope, which was a few blocks up and off, but I can't remember the name of the street. You had the Horoscope. I could not get in there because they had a very strict doorman or doorwoman, Carolyn Sue Wilson, one of the most famous drag queens in Roanoke, who was a Miss Gay Roanoke. I don't think she hit Miss Gay Virginia, but she was a Miss Gay Roanoke. She was the doorman there, and you could not get your ass past Carolyn. If she knew you were underage, there's no way you'd get in, so I never even tried. Then there was Murphy's. I had a fake ID. I could get into Murphy's. That was good. All right, then you had, the big old bad granddaddy of them all, the Trade Winds. God, the Trade Winds was legendary. It was where the very first Miss Gay Roanoke pageant was held back in the 70s. I only went there a few times. It was going downhill by the time I got there. So it was a bunch of old trolls. But in its day, it was run by a pair of brothers who were straight but knew the gay community. And as long as you were cool and didn't act out too obviously out or touch other guys, they were cool with you. And it was another one of those things. It was a restaurant by day, a bar later at night. And it was on the corner of Elm and Franklin. It's no longer there. There's a law office across the street from where it was that's Krasno and Cott.
Yeah, I know where you're
the guy with the beard that's always on TV that handles truck
always
wrecks.
On commercials, yeah.
Yeah, the legal community calls it the Taj Mahal because it's that big brick place. Yeah. All right, well, the Trade Winds, there was a gas station there for years that got torn down, but that was where a gas station was. Across the street was the Trade Winds. Oh, my God, it was a bomb shelter. But it was historic. I mean, that is the granddaddy of Roanoke gay bars, the Trade Winds. They probably tore it down in the 80s, maybe, and by then the brothers were older and dying, but that was the hub for many years of the gay community in Roanoke, was the Trade Winds and the Last Straw. Okay, so then came the later era, which I guess I'm a part of. I'm a part of the second generation of gays in Roanoke. The first generation was like in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. They started the first gay liberation organization in Roanoke. They started the Rogues, Levi Leathers Club. Many of those boys were arrested by the vice squad. Many of the boys lost their jobs when it was found out they were gay. I knew quite a few of those guys. They were all older. Danny Jones, who I know you all must have interviewed in the past. He worked at the downtown library for years. Danny can tell you all about those days because that he was a vital part of that. He and Lee Cruz and a few others were very vital. I was the next wave. I came of age in the disco era. Donna Summers, the whole nine yards. I came around in the 70s was when I was a teenager. So I'm the second wave of the gay tide in Roanoke. So when I was in my teens, later teens, the park opened. And I consider the park the big deal as far as the 70s, 80s, and 90s go, as far as bar life. This was before social media, any of that crap. I mean, back in that day, there was a magazine called The Advocate. They had the pink pages with classified ads that you could write to other men all around the country and become pen pals or go meet them in Trick or whatever. So the park was very much, it became the hub of the gay community in Roanoke. They started really going to town with Miss Gay Virginia, Miss Gay Roanoke, Mr. Star City. They started sponsoring part of the gay pride, the Pride Day that came around. I was one of the first people involved with starting the gay auction that helped the gay organizations. Howard Nash and I started the first gay auction held at Jerry Jennings' house in the mid to later 80s. And we did two or three there. Then someone else took it over and they started doing it at MCC. But Howard and I were the ones that started that. I guess I should talk a little bit about what I was in the gay community. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was Tommy Fazell, and I was on the first board of the Roanoke AIDS Project, but I could not continue with that because my best friend Jimmy became ill and my mother became ill with cancer. So I lasted on that maybe 6 months to a year, but I was there when it started at the health department in Vinton. That was where we met to start. I was part of Madonna House, which was the gay rap group that met once a week. Jerry Jennings started that. I got into it, I would guess, in 1983, when I came back to Roanoke from college. I had been a guest there during college, but I became a member when I came back. And that was the gay rap group. There are still couples together to this day that met at Madonna House, at the gay rap group. There are still men in the community who, because of the rap group, got the courage to come out to their families. A lot of good gay things were born at the rap group at Madonna House. That was, you know, where the nuns lived over at Our Lady of Nazareth back in the day when it was downtown Roanoke. So Jerry Jennings helped start that, and then I got real involved in it. Okay, so then at the park, as you see here, and I guess you can still hear me on your thingy, I did the posters.
like, here is the New Year's Eve, the park's, you know, 93 New Year's Eve party. I did all the posters from the mid-80s when I returned from college through the mid-90s. Here's another Halloween party poster. All right, now this is from Lambda Horizons, which was the gay student group at Virginia Tech, which was really kicking ass in, let me see the date on this, 1986. All right, in the mid-80s, there was a boy named Mark. I can't think of his last name. He was the president of this. He was out of shit. He was kicking ass. And so Lambda Horizons and the Roanoke Pride Group worked together quite often to throw events to raise money for Lambda Horizons. Like, you can see, this was at the Fox Ridge Apartments in Blacksburg. So, the Briarwood Club. So, I mean, this is gay history right here, because these kids were out there getting the shit beat out of them, but they were doing it. I was so proud of them. Okay, this is a New Year's poster at the park, you know. So this was the sort of thing I did. And this was showing gay people that gay guys did art, you know. I also did artwork, but I couldn't sell it in Roanoke because it was too forward. It was more like Tom of Finland stuff, and galleries were scared to touch it. So, and I've still got some of that upstairs, and I've sold some of it. So anyway,
what was the process of you getting involved doing the art and things like that?
All right, I came back from college, from VCU in Richmond, where, yes, I did get fag-bashed. Had to have my face redone the first time, but my sister sent money so my parents wouldn't know. So, all right, oh, this was what I sort of looked like. This was my senior portfolio picture. Yay! So, yeah, I did that. So, I did my own artwork. This is from college.
That's
when
awesome.
I posed for the nude modeling sessions. Good God. This is, like I've told you before, the park was known for its Halloween parties. And they had competitions. And people would come from all over the state and West Virginia to be in this competition. And, I mean, it was something. It was something. And I remember one year, Dane, a friend of mine, I'm not saying last names because I don't know if these guys are comfortable with being put on tape. He went as Glinda the Good Witch from The Wizard of Oz and made that costume, and it was awesome. Hoops and everything. And the cellophane crown with the jewels, and he won. And then sold that costume to a professional drag queen who wore it in pageants nationwide. Yeah, isn't that cool?
That's really cool
as hell. All right. I was also known as Mary Read Your Beads. Yes, here I am. Someone gave me a bolt of heavy blue fabric, and I found an old pair of hoops at a thrift store, and I drafted it and made it. Remember, my major was fashion design, so I could make patterns and sew. So I made my own nun's outfit with hoops under it and everything. Here's my flying nun headdress that I made. And so Mary Read Your Beads did two Pride in the Parks. It was when it was in Wasina Park. My tent was made out of Ralph Lauren chintz, and we hung a chandelier in the tree. I will never forget it. I mean, we were really kicking ass. We had tickets printed that said, Mary, read your beads, and had a cross and prayer at hands. So, and people would pay me a dollar, and I'd read their fortunes. Now, I cheated. Like, some of the people came in, I knew who they were, and I knew what they'd been up to. I was a horrible gossip. So, like, I actually started some shit. Because, like, one gay couple came in, and I knew one was cheating on the other one. So, I was reading my crystal ball, and I had a button that made it light up. And if it went white, you were going to heaven. If it went red, you were going to burn in hell. So, I was reading my crystal ball, and I hit, the button was under my ass. So, I just reached back and hit the button, and it went flame red. And I turned to one of the gay guys, and I said, you will burn. And he was like, what? I said, you were in the back of a car with someone that looked like blah, blah, blah. And the lover turned to him and went, you son of a bitch. I know who it is. And I mean, it was fabulous. They started a fight in my tent. We had to get them out. So that was wonderful. I started a fight with a mother and daughter because I knew the girl was fooling around with some trashy guy from Southeast Roanoke. And so I described his car and everything. And the mother was like, you whore! And smacked the girl. Oh, it's wonderful! So that was Mary Read Your Beads. I was in the Gay Bowling League for many years. I started with them on their second... they had fall and summer leagues. They started with a summer league, and I went, and this was in the mid-80s, and I went in as a replacement bowler on their first league, and then from then on, I was a member for years. I was the first winner of the Miss Style Award, because when I started to bowl, and that's not a drag award, I could not bowl. So when I bowled to begin with, I was on my knees and pushed the bowl down the lanes, so like a retardo, and they named me Miss Style. And so as a result, they had the Miss Style Award. And for many years, I won that award, but then a hairdresser came along, and he had a lot of style, and we started to trade it back and forth, me and Jim, you know, Miss Style, Miss Style. But I was the first Miss Style. I was the first Miss Grand in theater. Julie Hunsaker had this movie called To Wong Fu with Love, Julie Newmar, with Patrick Swayze. Well, the premiere night, it was all over the news in Roanoke that they were going to have a drag competition with, you won a year's supply of movie passes and popcorn, I think it was. Well, I didn't do drag, but I did Mary Reager beads, which, you know, was kind of radical drag. I had a beard and all. But so what I did was I had a 77 Monte Carlo, one of those big boats with swivel seats in it. That's the only way I could get the damn hoops in the car. So I dressed up as Mary Reager Beads, got a parking space right in front of the theater. I will never forget it, right there on Grandin Road. Went sweeping in. They had to put a chair in the aisle because my skirts were too big to get me into the theater seats. They had the competition, and my friend said, get up there, get up there. It's a bunch of drag queens, street people. And I was like, oh, never. But I went up there. And as part of your competition, you had to dance. So all of these girls were up there shimmying and doing all this nasty shit. So when I got up there, I could sing. So I started to sing The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music. And I started to twirl. I went into the rapture with my crucifix. And they started screaming, the nun, the nun. And I won the competition. So I'm the first Miss Grand in theater. So, all right, this is when I was a character singer with Opera Roanoke. I was a trained vocalist, a baritone, and I won my state competition, and then I was in Opera Roanoke, and I'm very proud because I speak no languages. I learned everything phonetically on a tape recorder.
Wow.
My vocal coach,
very impressive.
My vocal coach would speak the words for me, and I can't read music, but I'm very musical. So I would learn the music. I would take me forever to learn the lyrics, but I learned them, and I won my state competition. I was very proud of that. In my 30s by then. This is when I was a socialite. Now, back then, gay was glamorous to a lot of people. So I had Thomas Jefferson hair. It was in a ponytail, and I'd wear a moiré ribbon bow tied in it, and pearls around my throat, and lace fichus, and ascots, and all this crap. And I had a riding habit coat that was tied at the waist, and a flared skirt, you know, the whole nine yards. So, and that's how I would go out. I was, you know, Willie Walter, Tommy Fazell. Oh, Willie Walter. Willie Walter was the column I wrote, oh my God, for 15 years, 15 to 20 years, from the early 80s until the early 2000s. So probably, I don't know, 20 years, I was Willie Walter, but I didn't tell anybody, but some people knew. So I wrote the Willie Walter column, which was really well known. People liked it. I wrote about political issues. I wrote about how to date gay men. I wrote about when my mother died. I wrote about being proud and gay. I wrote about how to deal with harassment. I wrote about all sorts of stuff. It was just, you know, how to be gay.
How did you find out about the Blue Ridge Lambda Press?
Oh, that was Jerry Jennings. Jerry was one of my dear friends. Okay, let me get into this. Now we're getting into Lynchburg gay history. In Lynchburg, there was a group called PALS, Positive Alternative Lifestyles. And it was up here in Lynchburg. And Doug and Dave ran it. And they were restoring historic homes on Madison Street and Harrison Street, off of Fifth Street in Lynchburg. They were part of the big gay wave of restoring historic homes. That's where that started. Later, 10 years later, it shifted to Diamond Hill. But at that time, it was on, I think it's called Garland Hill. Anyway, the streets are named after presidents. So Jerry started bringing me up there during my college breaks. I would go to PALS meetings in Roanoke. I mean, in Roanoke, in Lynchburg, excuse me. And we'd go up there. And there was a very active gay community in Lynchburg. They all came to the bar on Saturday night to the park. But all the rest of the time, they were having dinner parties and things up here in Lynchburg. So they had the gay newsletter, the PALS newsletter. I think it was called the PALS newsletter then. When those guys moved on to other things, they sort of gave the newsletter to Jerry. And Jerry brought it to Roanoke.
and the name became the Blue Ridge Lambda Press, BRLA. And it became known as the Pink Pages, because the paper was pink to make it stand out. Plus, pink was the color of the triangles worn in World War II by the gay inmates in the concentration camps. I mean, we had that blurb in there. That's why the pages are pink. So we had the Pink Pages. And we handled a huge variety of topics. I mean, it was the way that gay men communicated in a lot of ways. They were at the bars. We put them at the bars. We had a mailing list that was highly confidential, highly discreet. You guarded it with your life because you could get back. This was when you could still get in trouble for gay publications. So we would meet in each other's homes and have the mailing parties where we'd sit there and lick labels and put them on the things. And we had to take them all to the post office and get them bulk mailing, you know, rated and mailed. And it was a lot of work. I edited it for 1 year. 1985. At the end of 85, I moved to Charlotte for 1 year for my career. But at the end of 86, and the day I moved down here was the day the Challenger blew up. Because as I drove down the interstate, 77, everyone's had their headlights on, and I didn't know what had happened until I got to Charlotte and found out the Challenger had blown up that afternoon. But let me segue into this. Okay. So I was the editor of the gay newsletter for 1 year, and then I moved to Charlotte for my career, but my mother fell ill and my best friend fell ill. He had AIDS, she had breast cancer. So I gave up my career and moved back here to Roanoke at the time. I'm in Lynchburg now. But anyway, my career was I went to VCU in Richmond, Virginia Commonwealth. I got in a lot of trouble because in senior high school, my guidance counselor told my mother that I should not go to VCU because it was a bunch of faggots. And I got mad, and I said to her in front of my mother, "Oh, honey, you haven't heard the little rhyme? Let's all go to VCU, where girls are girls and boys are too." And she got pissed. And I did a gay hand gesture, and she got really hot. And so I went to VCU. And that was where I was fag-bashed twice. Both times I was perfectly innocent. I was going to class and was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
If you're willing to talk about it, how did those two incidences really affect you and change you as a person?
Pissed me off. Made me gayer than ever. Screw them. Be damned if they were going to beat me into the ground. Just like those damn kids in high school. You know, they had the nerve to push me into my locker and stroke me and say what they'd like to do to me. But by God, they wouldn't touch me in public. Mm-hmm. And these people are the same way. Bunch of damn cowards. Beat me up in an alley. I mean, like I said, the first time was bad. I mean, my sister sent me money so I could get my face fixed because I didn't want Mama and Daddy to know because they would have pulled me straight home. When I was in Richmond, gay wasn't really out. And, you know, you had to kind of figure out if there was anywhere to go. And there were two clubs in Richmond that were gay. But it was real quiet. One was called Lachlan's, which was a dance bar. And that's where everybody went on Saturday night. All the men went there, real cruisy. And there was another one that I cannot remember now, but it was where I went my freshman year. It was a very small cocktail bar in downtown Richmond, and I had to walk there. Oh, that was scary, and it took me forever to get there. I can't think of the name of it. And the reason I picked up on it, they advertised in one of the student newsletters. And something about the ad stuck me. It's really queer. I mean, it was like cocktail glasses tipped to the side with bubbles coming out or something. Something you wouldn't put in a butch, you know, publication. But I thought, that's a queer bar. And that's where I went. But they were only around a year or so after I came to school. They closed. There was an older man. And you know, it had been around for years and it closed. So then Lachlan's became the big one. But then there was a Broadway cafe on Broad Street, which was mostly lesbian, but they had drag shows one night and the week, and that was tons of fun. And then when I was there, the Cha-Cha Club opened up my senior year. It was an old bank building on Cary Street, and it was a mixed crowd, gay, drag, straight, you know, real avant-garde, real fun. I mean, and that was pretty cool. But then I came back to Roanoke. I had a summer at Dartmouth. After I got out of college, I got a fellowship and went to Dartmouth for a summer in costuming. But got homesick, came back to Roanoke instead of going to New York like I should have. But I came home. And that was where I started really letting it rip. Got my own apartment in Old Southwest for $150 a month or $200 a month.
Wow.
It was rough. It was the worst neighborhood. Whores, drugs. A woman got shot to death behind my car my first weekend there. Scared
wow.
me to death. Oh, it was wonderful. It was the middle of the night. These drunks were fighting, and I was asleep. It was Saturday night. I had to get to church on Sunday. I heard this voice in the darkness yell, "By God, if you were any sort of a man, you'd shoot me." And it got real quiet. And there's this... And then this other drunk voice goes, "By God, he did." And so I look out the window, and it's like the Wizard of Oz. I can see a foot behind the bumper of my car and a puddle of blood. And I'm calling my mother 2 in the morning on my rotary dial phone going, "Oh, I want to come home." And Mama's going, "You picked it out. You paid the rent. You stay."
Oh,
so, yeah, it was cool. It was on 7th Street. 7th Street.
Wow.
Oh, God, I used to remember the address, but I can't now. 708 something. But, yeah, that was really cool. So that was my first apartment. I always had my own apartments. That was my vow. When I got out of college, my father had a rule. You had a college degree, you had 3 months to get out. And that was the rule. He didn't care if you had any money or not. You had a degree, by God, you could get a job and get out of the house. So I did. And I became a window dresser. And I worked for Miller and Rhodes. I worked for Tallheimer's. I've had my year in Charlotte at Ivy's of the Carolinas. I worked for upper-scale Southern department stores. That's where the mannequins come from that are around my living room.
And yes. Gorgeous.
And ball gowns and jewels, yes. Tregay. So, window dressing was a job that a gay person could get into in Roanoke and do. Because there was the gay stereotype. Gay men have good taste. That is a huge stereotype. That is why so many women want gay friends, because gay men know makeup, they know hair, they know clothes, they know interiors. You know, and when my first gay pride I went to in 1983 in Washington, that they had signs they were carrying, "Gay myth number 1, gay number 8, gay number 15, and one of them said, "Gay men have good taste." And I just screamed, because that worked. If you knew how to work it, it worked in your favor in Roanoke. Because a gay man would know how to do hair. A gay man would know how to dress windows. A gay man could be a florist, an interior designer. So there were professions that you could be gay in and be safe. It was expected. So I was a window dresser. I did mannequins. I did floral arrangements. I did interior settings. You know, I had a career doing that. And back then, you could have a career in that field in smaller southern towns. Now you can't. All of that's gone. I mean, it's only in the big cities like New York or Philadelphia or Baltimore. I mean, it's gone. Back then, people don't realize in small towns, even like Roanoke, there were department stores with big show windows. And they had mannequins. And you showed the fashions. You did the accessories. You did the whole nine yards. And I had a background in fashion design, so I was used to designing clothes, and I had live models to dress for the fashion shows. I mean, the girls would stand there naked with a panty shield and a pair of hose and heels on. That was it. Didn't bother me any. I mean, I'd just pin the muslins on and the whole nine yards, try not to stick them in the breast. But the male models were a bitch. They were the, "Oh, I don't want to queer, look at my junk." And I'm like, shut up and just shut your mouth. I was like, that is not what you're paid for. You're supposed to be pretty and stupid. Now shut up. You know, and I'd tell them, and you better be quiet, because I've got a straight pin in my hand, baby, and I'm fitting a Jansen on you. I will stick you in the dick. So, you know, yeah. So they learned real quick I was a mouthy queen, so leave me alone. So in Roanoke, that was an occupation I could do and be gay and get away with it. So I was a window dresser, and I was very, very good at it. I had a good career going with it, but then it went away. And the next thing I went into was furniture sales, because I had a very good eye, and I could do interiors. And so I became a furniture salesman, and I would go to people's homes for free and give them consultations and tell them what it should look like and what to do and sell them furniture. And that went very well. Until I got married and moved up here. And then I started as an assistant to an interior designer, but her clients liked me and started calling me. And so I lost my job. And this is a very small town. And I couldn't get a job to save my soul once phone calls were made. All designers up here are married to doctors, lawyers. It's all women. And I couldn't get a job after that. So now, at the end of my life, I'm a janitor, and I clean commodes and toilets at an elderly care facility. And let me tell you, old people are full of shit. I see it daily. I clean it up every... Oh, it's disgusting. Ugh. But I do it. I'm an adapter. I survive. My late grandmother raised me that Southerners bend, we don't break. So you do what you have to do. I mean, you come here and I've got a pretty house with mannequins and ball gowns and jewels. You'd never dream that at 4:30 in the morning, Tommy's in his khakis and a work shirt scrubbing crap out of a toilet. But yes sirree, Bob. That would be my message to y'all. Your life is never going to be what you think it's going to be. I had dreams of glory when I was in college. I was winning fashion awards. I mean, I went to Dartmouth for a summer. I thought I was going to be it. But I got homesick, and I came home, and I was the one my sister had left. And I was the one you end up having to stay and take care of your parents. And I took care of my parents till both of them died. I took care of my best friend till he died. I took care of four other gay boys that died. I was in Roanoke when AIDS hit. And it was a fucking plague. It was called the gay cancer. Acquired immunization. It wasn't, what was it known as? It wasn't even called AIDS back then. It was the gay cancer. But it hit Roanoke like a ton of bricks. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. All of a sudden, people were sick. And the thing about AIDS, it was hitting people in all economic levels. Back when I was in the gay world, in Roanoke, in the social scene, you had A gays, and you had B, C, D, street trash. I was on B level. I didn't have money, so I could not travel with the A gays. The A gays were like wealthy hairdressers, business owners, things like that. They were usually discreet. They might have younger toy boys, if you want to call it that. They had beautiful homes. Some A gays, or quite a few of them, were married with families, but were not out at all. Their wives might have suspected things, but, you know, you didn't say anything. But they had their guy friends, and they would go out of town. A gays mostly went out of town. They'd go on vacations. They'd go to Washington, or they'd go to the Bahamas, or, you know, they and the guys. I wasn't part of that circle. I didn't have money. I had a lot of style, a lot of pizzazz, but I didn't have any money. And I wasn't part of that set. So I watched them with great interest. Then there was B-level, like me. Fun, young, no money, but tons of style, lots of fun, through fun parties. You know, that was my set. But I was also part of the political scene. You know, A-gays did not do politics. No. Nothing that would blow the cover. You know, many gays in Roanoke would not invite me to their home or their parties because I was known. I was a known homosexual. You know, once you were known, it was like you made a lifestyle choice. You could either stay in the closet and get married and have kids and be quiet and be on the down low, like, you know, going to the public parks and picking up guys and shit like that, or going out of town and doing guys. But that was a whole different world. Once you were a known homosexual, it was different. There were homes you were not allowed in. There were people that would not speak to you. It was different, and you paid for it. But I never minded, because I was not going to be quiet, and I was not going to be a hypocrite. And I went to church every Sunday at my parents' church, but everybody damn well knew I was gay. And when I had my first boyfriend, I dragged his ass to church with me. Preacher had a fit, but I dragged him to church with me. I mean, I was gay. I mean, I didn't see any point in trying to hide it. I didn't see any point in trying to be a liar. I didn't see any point in trying to be something I wasn't. I was gay. And either deal with it or to hell with you. And it cost me a lot. It really did. But I wouldn't redo any of it, because my father and mother raised me to be a gentleman and to always be proud of yourself and to never behave in a manner that would embarrass you. So I was never drunk. I've never been drunk in my life. I've never had a beer in my life or a joint or anything. But I was gay and I was proud of it, and I behaved with dignity. And I had boyfriends that were out with me. I mean, I didn't hide them in a closet or sneak over to their apartment. Oh, hell no, they were with me. We'd go to movie theaters, you know. Mm-hmm. We had our heads up and we got called names, but by God, we were out there doing it. It was just a different world, and I'm so proud now of many of the youth that I see, that they don't know what struggles it was to get where we are now. Like, marriage equality was not even dreamed of when I was starting out. I mean, the thought of having a gay husband, oh my God, that was just beyond the pale. That month, please. But yeah, as soon as we're legal in the state of Virginia, within that month.
I'm y'all bored to death with the stories.
This is my husband, Rodney Lee Meek. Who has stories of his own to tell, but then has to tell, and I went, yes, you heard that, no. So.
When did you two meet?
At a funeral.
2003, May the 8th, at a funeral at St. John's Episcopal Church in Roanoke. Yes, I remember the day. May 8th, 2003. We met at a funeral. He came from Lynchburg to the funeral. I was in Roanoke at the time, living there. We'd never met. The church was packed. He ended up sitting beside me because he couldn't find a place to sit. He had the ugliest shoes on I've ever seen, and I told him so. And I knew he was not an Episcopalian because he didn't know the first damn thing about a prayer book. After the funeral, he pursued me. He
brought you a glass of water.
And I said, I don't drink. So then he went and got a glass of water and came at me. And I said, I'm not thirsty. So then he came at me when I was talking to someone. Oh, look at him shaking his head. See how discreet he is? And what did he say? You know what he said to me? Where do you live? And I said, up on the hill. And he said, what are we waiting for? That's how we met.
Oh my goodness, that's an awesome story.
He was very forward.
Tell him what you told Kent's grandmother. I think that's funny.
Oh my God. All right, Kent was the only other serious relationship I ever had. We met, I was 9 years older. Oh God, he was young. Kent was maybe 18. We met at a Labor Day party at a gay man's home. Kent was one of the prettiest boys I'd ever seen in my life. I had just got back from a beach vacation. The last one I took was 1990. That tells you how long ago this was. So I think that was 1988 I met him, 88 or 89. So anyway, we were at this Labor Day barbecue. These gay men, that was how it was done in Roanoke. It was a private event. And Kent, I didn't know this till many years later, Kent had been getting around quite a bit. And the man that invited him to the party was the host. And Kent and he had some encounters. Well, the man's other half was there. Kent didn't know the man had another half. The other half didn't know that his partner was fooling around. So we're all eating lunch. And I said in my ignorance to Kent, how do you know our host? And Kent, without thinking, said, we've met a few times. The partner was sitting two people down from him, stopped eating, turned to him and said, what the hell do you mean by that? Woo! Fight on! It was fabulous! Oh, it was wonderful. I had to meet Kent after that. Meet him. I thought, anybody can start a fight like that. And we ended up dating for several years. And Kent, I dragged Kent to my church. Set the minister off, but I dragged him to church. I dragged him to family reunions. I mean, we were out before it was out, you know? Mm-hmm. We were wearing rings. Oh, God, that set him off. But I was queer, and I was proud. So, and Kent was young and stupid and didn't know any better. So, I'm dragging him all over the place. And we were together during his college years. I went to his graduation, Roanoke College. But we went to he dragged me to Thanksgiving at his family's home in Buckhannon, Virginia, which is the back of hell. And we're in Buckhannon, Virginia. And his grandmother, Margaret, who was a bitch, a Pentecostal bitch, mean as hell, sitting there at the table, lunch, glaring at me the whole time. Kent was her favorite. She finally goes, you're going to burn in hell. And the table got dead quiet. And I smiled my nicest smile at her, and I said, and I'll meet you there, bitch. Well, that did it for that. We had to leave real shortly after that. She was choking on her damn gravy and potatoes. She'd never been talked to like that. Never. So, yeah, I was mouthy. So, but the rest of the family liked me because I was mouthy. Things still haven't changed that much, kids. You know, this year, my man and I have been together 20-some years. He took me home to meet his family last year. We'd been together forever, and he finally took me home. He is not as advanced as I am in many ways. And he finally took me home to meet his family, and it was brutal. His brother, the brother's wife, and their children were, oh, God, cold as ice, would not speak to me even when I was introduced to them. Turned and walked away. While the other cousins and all were fine, couldn't have cared less. We sat there screaming and throwing food at each other and having a great time. But the point I'm making is, there are still many people and many parts, this was in Ohio, where it just simply still is not the thing, where being gay is beyond the pale. His family is very religious, like mine was, but my parents loved me and gritted their teeth and put up with it. His family is... But it's just to show you that you can be gay at any age, but still in this day and time, being gay is not accepted to many people, and you have to have the courage to stand up. And even if you're not standing there waving a flag and screaming, I'm gay, I'm standing there with my husband with our wedding rings on, and they know damn well what the deal is. And I told him, when you introduce me, you either say I'm your husband, or we're going to have a fight right in front of him. So he had the balls enough to say, this is my husband, Tommy. He used to not be able to do that.
Why do you think, after so long, that, you know, you grew up through the scene in the 70s, that it's now 2022 and we're still facing these
Because
issues?
America is the only nation in God's world, the only democracy that's based on morality. We were started by Puritans. We were started for religious freedom. So, to the vast majority, and I live in Lynchburg, where Jerry Falwell's school is, you know, Liberty University, where kids, if they're openly gay, get thrown off of campus. That's still the deal. I mean, open homosexuals cannot teach there. They cannot attend school there. I mean, we have friends who worked at Liberty and were thrown out when they got married. And it was found out. That was this last year. And they were young. They were young guys in their 20s. They got married and got thrown out. So, and they were alumni. America is based on morality. As long as someone can point to Leviticus, or to one or two other places in the Bible, the letters of Paul, and say, gay is sinful, it is an abomination unto the Lord, then they've got an excuse. They used to justify slavery by the Bible. My grandfather used to quote it. It's in the Genesis, and they talk about the sons of Ham, the dark sons of Ham, and how they would forever be slaves to the other tribes and all this crap. And my grandfather used to read that, and he'd go, there, right there, God is saying, the black man is inferior, and slavery is the way of the righteous. And you'd sit there and go, oh my God. I mean, he threw a drinks party the day they buried Martin Luther King. He had the TV on with that, and was having a drinks party. Honey, let me tell you, I'm from a different time. When I went to college in Richmond, I lived at the Chesterfield, which was Richmond's first high-rise apartment building, 6 floors, oh yeah. But anyway, on the very first floor, Robert E. Lee's, I think it was great-great-granddaughter, lived there, Ms. Lee. And every afternoon, Ms. Lee would take the air, and she and her black maid, she was the only person that lived on the first floor, it was the tea room, where everyone in the building ate. But she had the one apartment there, and when Ms. Lee came through the lobby, and this is the late 70s, we all stood for her. And if you didn't stand, someone would smack you. And we all stood for that lady because she was Robert E. Lee's great-granddaughter, great-great-granddaughter. She was old as hell. But she, her black maid, and she would go to take the air. They'd go out and walk on Monument Avenue. When I was in Richmond, you used to see black maids in their little outfits on Broad Street waiting to catch the bus to the West End to clean the houses. Now it's Hispanic. That's, you have to remember, Americans always have to have somebody to look down on. With whites, they came over, they looked down on the Indians. So they stole their land and killed them and put them on reservations. Then, when they'd gotten rid of the Indians, they didn't want to do the work on their plantations, raising the cotton and the tobacco, so they started kidnapping blacks and bringing them over from Africa. You know, so they had someone to look down on. Well, now it's changed in the fact that now blacks have won a lot of their liberties and civil liberties. So now whose turn it is? Hispanics. Keep them out. You know, the wetbacks, keep them out. They speak a different language. And so now the jobs that blacks used to have, that whites wouldn't take, now the Hispanics are taking them. And it's just, in America, it's a land of hypocrisy. There will always be someone to look down on. Always.
So how did the segregation and prejudice China change the bar scene and the club scene?
Oh, God. Okay. When I first started going to bars, you did not see a lot of black gays. And God knows you didn't see any lesbians. Women and men did not mix. The men had their bars, the women had theirs. And women had a lot easier time of it. I have to admit that. Because in the South especially, a girl could have a girlfriend. You know, me and my girlfriends are going out, and me and my girlfriends are going here, and nobody thought a damn thing of it. I grew up in church where there were spinster women that roomed together. Because they didn't have anybody, so they roomed together. And now I look back and go, You know, when you room together 40-some years, But anyway, you know, Miss So-and-so and Miss So-and-so roomed together. Women had it a lot easier because they could pass. Men like me, who were flamboyant, we couldn't pass. You know, we just couldn't pass. Women had a lot easier time of it. There was a lot of prejudice in the gay community towards women. I can vividly remember having gay rights organizations, and the guys didn't want the girls in them. You know, didn't want no fish in the organization. And it was like, oh, come on, guys, we're all gay. Get over it. But it was like that. You know, they didn't want... And blacks, that was... I won't say it was much a gay thing as a white thing, because this was the South. I didn't see blacks in gay clubs. And I went to school in Richmond, which was a bastion of Southern, you know, civilization. And there were certainly no blacks in the clubs there, ever. Maybe it's changed now. But yeah, it was pretty segregated when I was coming along. I saw the last gasp of it. I'd say I saw the last gasp of the Old South in Richmond. Now, you've seen most of it get toppled in 2018 with Monument Avenue coming down and things like that. It's a different world. I grew up in a family. My mother's side was very, very proud of their Southern heritage. Our people fought in the Confederacy, and one of them's in a history book, and my mother's family was very proud of that. And it wasn't a race thing with them. Their thing was, these damn Yankees came down here and burned the houses and left us to starve. Screw them, get a gun, we're going after them. They could have cared less about blacks because they didn't own any slaves. But they sure as hell didn't like the Yankees coming down here and kicking our asses. So that's how my mother's family got involved in the war. It wasn't a black thing, it was a Yankee thing. Daddy told Mary Jo when she was going away to Norfolk that he would shoot her if she ever dated a damn Yankee. She needed to marry a Southern boy. And she did. She did. It was a big deal. One of my cousins is married to a beautiful woman of color. But they did that back in 1990 when that was unheard of. And I can vividly remember going out in public with them to dinner. Me and Kent and, you know, my cousin and his wife. And, oh, God. I can remember it being very unpleasant. Very unpleasant. I mean, the world hopefully will change more. In many ways, it has not changed. I mean, you know, I never ask you all, are you all heterosexual?
I'm queer.
Okay, you're queer.
Yeah.
You're straight.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're young. You all are what, in your 20s or something?
21.
I mean, do you all experience prejudice because of your sexuality?
I do, yes.
Still?
I'm very religious. Grew up in a very religious household.
Oh, my God.
So
yeah,
it's...
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm kind of fallen into faith and falling into religion, and it's been a fight with that. So that's kind of where mine's been.
Religion can really hurt you. Mm-hmm. I was raised to believe in the love of Christ, but, you know, all men are sinful, blah, blah, blah. And I was raised that by being gay, I was picking sin, that I was choosing this, you know. And I kept telling Mama, no, Mama, I was born gay. I said, I've always wanted men. I've never wanted a woman. And she's like, no, you choose that. That is your sinful nature. So... as long as our country is based on religion, and as long as people can get away with kicking your ass in the name of religion, it's going to be a fight for gay youth, because their parents will have the best of intentions, but they won't want their child to be gay. And that was where my family was coming from. It was sinful. You know, why would you choose that? It's an abomination unto the Lord. And it's like, oh God Almighty. So hearing you say that amazes me that still it's like that. But then again, my husband's family last year. My God, we're in our 60s. So.
What would you say to queer youth now who are going to potentially be facing things like this?
Keep your head up. Chin up. Screw them. Be yourself. Screw them, screw them, screw them. Do not give in. Now, I would say if you live in the backwoods and it's a matter of life and death, then you keep your mouth shut till you can get the hell out of there. Protect yourself. But if it's you're not going to die, you might get the shit beat out of you like I did, but you know you're not going to get killed, yeah, try to be yourself. Try to set an example. Try to be proud. I was just too dumb to know any better. You know, if I thought about it, I'd probably kept my mouth shut. But I didn't know any better. I was always me, and that was it. I would just tell kids, love yourself, take care of yourself, don't be afraid to love other people. Know that, like straight people, you're going to be hurt. Love is not easy, and you're going to be hurt. Know that gay love is different from straight love. Straight love is accepted by society. Gay love, in many ways, is still not. And you'd better be damn strong if you're going to be in a relationship and be out in public. You'd better be a strong person. I would tell gay youth, don't drink. That was the big crutch of my day. Drinking and drugging because people couldn't handle the pressure of being gay and not accepted. I didn't do it because I promised Mom and Daddy I wouldn't, and I was just too damn bullheaded. I wouldn't have been a nasty drunk. You know, I was proud of myself. So I would tell kids, don't use drugs and drink as a crutch. Be proud of what you are. Be who you are. If you have to wait until you can get the hell out of town, then do it. I had to wait till I was out of... Well, I say I waited until I was at college, but shit, I was getting beat up anyway in Roanoke. I was known as a queer. It's not going to be easy. And if I had kids, I would pray to God they'd be straight so they'd have it easier. But at the same time, if they were gay, I'd say, all right, kid, you know, just get your chin up and know that you're going to get your ass kicked. But you got to keep going. Don't give up. You don't get nothing by giving up.
Absolutely. And I guess my last question to kind of encapsulate everything is, we talked about your childhood a lot, and if you had the opportunity to go back and say something to your younger self, what would you tell that person?
I'm going to put a condition on that. If there had been no AIDS in this world, I would have told my younger self, for God's sake, be a lot more of a whore than you were. Because there's a lot I didn't do because I was too scared to. If there were no AIDS, I'd tell myself, for God's sake, experiment, go out there, have fun. But I was prissy. I was scared of diseases. You know, Daddy told me horror stories of World War II where he watched these social disease movies where the sailors' peckers fell off from social diseases. And he said he was a virgin for years after that. So, you know, I was scared of anything. But I would have, if AIDS hadn't been around, I would have told myself, experiment, try things, don't be afraid. Now, having said that, what would I tell myself knowing that AIDS was around? Never give up. It'll come out all right at the end. But you got to keep fighting. You can't give in. Don't give up. Don't let the bastards whip you. Because at the end, if you're lucky, it comes out all right.
Absolutely.
I'm sitting here in 2022 in a home with a legally married husband. My peers that died from AIDS back in the 90s. My friends that died of natural causes all through the years. None of them would ever have thought this was possible. That you could sit here with a wedding ring on your hand. That you could have gotten married in a mainstream church. That you could say to in public, oh, this is my husband, which I now say all the time. That would have been science fiction back when I was coming up. No one would ever have believed that. And now... But I do think we have to be on our guard. I think we could lose that privilege. I think that Roe versus Wade will be overturned. I think abortion will be outlawed again. Now, if people had to grow up hearing what my mother, the story she used to tell of women didn't have an alternative, so you ended up going to a backstreet butcher was what they call them. Mama told me stories of knitting needles, clothes hangers, stuff like that, because good girls didn't get knocked up, honey. So if a good girl all of a sudden was pregnant, you had to do something about it. And if your family didn't have the money to send you to a doctor quietly, then you did whatever it took. And Mama knew girls that died because infection set in. So I think that we have to be on our guard. I think abortion's going to be overturned. I think the next thing on the agenda will be gay rights. I think gay marriage is a huge burr up the ass of conservative America. It drives them crazy. There are people in Lynchburg, when they see me and Rodney out and they see our rings on my, you know, it, you see their ears just lay back. There are people, when I say this is my husband, I see them just, but they'll be polite. Mm-hmm. You know. I've been called names here in Richmond several times when Rod and I have been out in public. And I just grit my teeth and just, you know, because of him and his reputation and his job up here, I have to be somewhat dignified. You know, yeah. You have to, once you get married, you have to learn, you have to consider someone else besides yourself. It's not all about you. And when you're married to someone who has a certain position or a certain job at a certain corporation, you have to grit your teeth and you have to bite your tongue. And you have to tone it down. Oh, those are three words I hate that I've heard my whole life. Tone it down. I hate that damn phrase. Tone it down my ass. Get out of here. So, you know, I've had to be polite to people in this house that just pissed me off, that I felt like a hypocrite. But because of my husband, I had to be gracious when I was dying. You know, it's just one of those things. That's one thing I would tell kids. If you choose to be out, there will be a price to be paid. I would tell any gay kid that. It's still that way. I don't care how far they say we've come. You know, you get a lot farther in America in the business and professional worlds if you grit your teeth and get married and have kids and go on the down low. I had that opportunity. I dated a girl 5 years. We almost got married. My father adored her. She was gorgeous. And she was cool. She said, as long as you screw guys, I don't care. She said, the first time you touch another woman, I'll kill you. And I was like, whew. Daddy told me that. He said, that's a hell of an offer. Take her up on it. He said, your life will be a lot easier. But I couldn't do it because I had been raised that wedding vows were sacred. That you take someone for life in front of God and man. And I couldn't do that to her. I told her, I mean, oh, it was a horror. We cried our eyes out when we broke up. But I told her, I want you to have a man who loves you thoroughly, in bed and out. I said, it would eat you alive to know that I was always looking at guys, even if we had sex and had kids. I would have loved to have had children. My husband has a son. He was married for 20-some years.
Wow.
And has a son who now has a fiance. That's been different. Yes. I have a stepson. That feels strange. Strange.
Does it almost feel like you're living, like, the part of you that always wanted to have children, even though he's older?
It's not the same. Mm-hmm. I would have dearly loved to have had a child who would have had, like, my father's eyes or my mother's eyes. Mm-hmm. Someone that I could look at and see one of my parents who've been dead. Mama's been gone 30-some years, mm-hmm. and Daddy's been gone 15 or 16. I would have given anything to look at a child and see my mother's face again. I mean, that sort of thing. The fact that my sister is named after my mother and my grandmother, that sort of thing goes on and on. Now, this is a strange night. My sister is very religious. Mm-hmm. When she found out I was gay, and I told her, I was 15, she made a decision not to have children because she thought that gay was hereditary, which it is, the genes. You know, mm-hmm. you know. She thinks that being gay is an abomination unto God, and she never wanted to have an abomination on her.
Wow.
So my sister has never had children, which has broken my heart. But she would not have children because she believes that being gay is an abomination.
How did that affect your guys' relationship?
We love each other. And she's very gracious to Rodney. But we're not bosom buddies. We don't visit each other very often. Mm-hmm. We have phone calls every couple of months. Every 4 or 5 months, we might see each other at a family reunion. But we are not an active part of each other's lives.
Well, is there anything else that you want to speak about, talk about? Anything at all?
Is there anything you want to ask me? I'm an old fag. You better be asking me. God knows how long I got to go.
I guess the one thing I did want to ask you, and then this will be my last thing that I ask.
I don't care. Ask away, baby.
Yeah. I was very interested in kind of knowing what life was like after the tragedy of Backstreet Cafe.
All right, Backstreet. I'm trying to remember. My memory's not as good. I think it was the early 1990s, early to mid. I would have been there that night, but I had another engagement and went to the park later on. The man that was the shooter, whose last name was Gay, had always been teased and tormented because of his name and was determined to seek vengeance. The whole thing about Backstreet was he went to the wrong bar. He wanted the park and had been to another bar in downtown Roanoke. I'm trying to think if it was Billy's Ritz or Alexander's, a straight place, and asked directions to a gay bar and ended up, as far as I remember, he was walking and ended up stopping at Backstreet because it was the first bar he came to and he did not realize the park was two blocks further. That was where he was supposed to be. Wow. That was where he meant to go. But they gave him directions and he ended up stopping at Backstreet. That was a fluke. If he'd gotten to the park, it would have been a damn massacre. Because the park was swinging in those days, baby. I was part of that. It was swinging. Instead, he ended up at Backstreet. And he shot a lovely young man, Danny, and killed him. A lovely boy. Danny bled to death in someone's arms. He didn't die immediately, but he bled to death. I had friends that were injured that night. I had a girl that grew up over the hill from me in my childhood who lost, I think it was 2 fingers of one hand. She was never the same after that and committed suicide. I had another friend, he was there that night, he committed suicide down the road. The Backstreet Massacre really brought to light a lot of damn ugliness because Ted Koppel and Nightline came to Roanoke to discuss the Backstreet Massacre. They had Neff Powell, the Episcopal Archbishop, was on the panel. They had some Baptist ministers. And I think they had an educator. But anyway, it was heartbreaking because the majority of the audience and the people interviewed were said there was nothing wrong with him taking out the trash, getting rid of the faggots. It was a huge thing. And kids in high schools, which I had really hoped would start coming out, I think that really stymied a lot of kids when they saw the hatred and the ugliness. You know, it was not a positive experience. And it scarred the people that were in that bar that night. It ended up causing death down the road from people that just couldn't handle life anymore. It, you know, the one boy died that night, and it caused a lot of pain and misery. But beyond that, it's like a stone in a pond with the circles, the ripples. The out ripples went out into the community. And all of a sudden, people were afraid again. It had been loosening up. You know, there was a lot of hope in the community. But it started tightening back down. And the religious people got their oars in the water. And then the kids started being scared again, you know. And it was, of all the damn places in America, it had to happen in Roanoke, Virginia. But it could have been so much worse. If he'd made it to the park, I can't tell you how many people would have died. I can't, because he had enough ammo, he could have taken out more people than the one guy he killed and the few that he hurt.
Do you think when... So, Gay, the one who had shot, just recently passed away in prison. How do you think that kind of reacted to people who were there? And people who knew each other like yourself, did it bring up like old memories and kind of almost like reliving the situation?
No. It's in the past. It's in the past. I would have hoped that we've gotten a lot farther down the road to equality and acceptance. But I don't think we're that much farther down the road. I think a lot of people pay lip service to be politically correct, but in their heart of hearts they still don't like gay people and they wouldn't want their child involved with one and they'd rather see gay people die. It's just a harsh truth. And besides, you got to remember, you live in the South, the Bible Belt, but it's equally ugly up north. You know, people just don't talk about it as much. You can still, for years, you could still get away with being ugly and nasty and hateful to gays and even killing them, because it was such a moralistic society and there were no laws to save gays' asses. I mean, we still don't have proper safety nets for discrimination in housing, jobs. We don't. I mean, if you keep your mouth shut and think of another reason, you can still deny a gay person the privilege of renting from you. You know, marriage equality, God, that's been a fight from hell, and I think we're going to lose it. I mean, it's just, as long as we're a faith-based country, you're always going to be able to discriminate and get away with it because it's part of your religion, and we believe in religious freedom.
So what specifically, or like, what kind of ripple effect do you think would have to happen for there to be change? And what? How long do you think that would take?
I can't answer that, because I would have thought that gay people being shot and massacred would have changed things, like the Pulse nightclub in Florida. But it hasn't. You can still get away with killing a gay person or beating the shit out of them. A straight boy can get away with beating the hell out of a gay guy if he goes, he made a pass at me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that way. It's just that way. And gay people can't claim the mark at all bigotry and oppression. Women still face horrendous fights every day of their lives. I mean, you were probably too young for this, but I'm trying to think, the Supreme Court nominee Clarence Brown, when, was it Anita Hill, that the huge battle, she was a legal assistant or something, and he sexually harassed her, and she brought it to court and testified at his hearings for the Supreme Court, and they still ignored her and put him on the Supreme Court. That was an outrage. They tried to paint that woman as being a stupid bitch. She was brilliant. She had a legal degree. She was no fool. I mean, but she was a woman. She was a black woman, you know. And the thing that got me so pissed off was he was a black man. And they still treated her like that. His own wife came out against her. I was like, and it's still that way. I mean, I'm looking now at the situation in the Ukraine, which horrifies me. We should be helping them, and we're not. But one thing that people don't realize is, when Putin takes over the Ukraine, all gay rights will instantly be done away with. Gay people will instantly be imprisoned. I mean, you can't be gay in the USSR, or Russia, as it's now called. You can't be gay in Russia. There are stories every day of atrocities. Gay youth and all. You're arrested, you're put in prison for immorality. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they get to Ukraine had civil liberties for gays. They had equality. They had, and I mean, the gays there, I would be trying to get the hell out as fast as I could go, because once the Soviets get their hands on you, you're going to be imprisoned. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at the African countries, mm-hmm. where to Africans, the number one religion, European religion, that has been brought to them is Catholicism. And as a result of that, African nations with strong Catholic heritage view gayness as a sin, and they have horrible punishments for it. Horrible! I mean, right now the Episcopal Church is being torn apart because the Episcopal Churches in Africa do not want gay clergy. Do not want gay marriage. Do not want gay acceptance.
How has your religion been through your like life with being out gay and growing up religious and then seeing all of the things that are going on around you?
Okay. I was a Presbyterian for many, many years. That's how I was born and bred. That was my heritage. Through mother's side of the family, we were purebred Pres. And I can vividly recall before I left the Presbyterian Church for about 5 or 6 years in a row, I would be nominated every year from the floor by the congregation to be an elder. And every year the pastor would squelch it because you didn't put a gay man on the session. And that used to enrage me because my fellow congregants thought enough of me that I was a Sunday school teacher. I was a youth group leader. You know, I did all of these things with kids and all, and they trusted me. And I had a boyfriend, and we were in a monogamous relationship, and he came to church with me. And yet, by being honest and all, I was denied a place at the table. That used to enrage me. The Episcopals are not that much more liberal. I have a friend who is now an openly gay man in a relationship. He's not married, but he has been asked to serve on the vestry of his church, which is huge, because he's openly gay. So we're making a little bit of progress.
Absolutely.
Presbyterians, not so much. Episcopals are trying. Catholics, no way. Pentecostals, oh, hell no.
How do you feel about Southern Baptist?
Now, Southern Baptist, when I was growing up, Southern Baptists were cool. They, as long as you kept your mouth shut and your zipper shut around the church, they would kind of overlook things. If you went to church on Sundays, patriotize. But then it went all to hell. When the gay, as my mother said, when you gays started pushing, you know, that's when it... But I was like, why shouldn't we push, Mama? Why shouldn't we have a place at the table? I said, you raised me. I said, think about that. You raised me with my morals, and I still turned out gay. You know, that used to burn her ass up. Daddy used to tell Mama all the time, he's queer, it's all from your side of the family, Joe. Daddy didn't know he had, there were at least 5 gay people on his side of the family, and none that I could find on Mama's. And she'd always go, keep your mouth shut. You'll kill him. Don't say a word.
At this point, what would you, if you had the opportunity to also see your mother and father again and show them everything you have and built and have done, what would you like to tell them or hope that they would tell you?
I'm okay. It turned out okay. Nobody killed me. I'm fine. I got a husband. We're monogamous. Nobody's burned the house down yet. We still got our jobs. You know, I would tell them, don't worry. It's okay. You know, I think that was what they were so scared of, because they knew about one of the fag bashings, and I mean, they were so terrified. Mama used to tell me all the time, she said, now son, one of these days, after I'm gone, there will come a time, like was in the war, she said, they're going to come for y'all. She said, they're going to get you, because you've run your mouth all these years, and pushed. And I said, that might be true. She said, I just want you to know, they're going to come after y'all again. She said, now we wanted you to be safe, but you kept running your mouth. She said, they'll get you. And I said, I know. I won't back down, Mama. I'll stand up for myself. She used to worry about that all the time. And I remember when AIDS really hit, Ronald Reagan was governor in California. And he wanted to take all the AIDS patients and all the gays and put them on, I want to say Alcatraz. It was an island there in California out in the bay. And he came out in public and said that we need to put all of them together. Put them all in the same place. Get that sickness and all together. They can be sick. You know, a lot of people still feel like that. I suppose if you asked Mitch McConnell, he wouldn't be too gay pro.
I'd have to agree with you.
Yeah. There's a lot of ugliness still out there. You can do the easy thing and hide and marry a straight person, have your kids. But I'd tell you, if you did that, by God, if one of your kids says, I'm gay, then you back them up. Don't you dare give them shit. You know, have the guts to back that kid up and say, you might not have to come out to them. I know, it might kill them. But you could tell that kid, okay, I'm with you. That's what enrages me so much, when I know gay people in the closet that talk against gay people. I've been spit in the face at gay parties before and been told, because of fags like you, it makes it harder for fags like us. And then the same damn people end up benefiting from the fight of people like me. They get their marriage equality. They get their rights. But they didn't have the balls to fight for it. And that just pisses me off. I mean, that burns my ass up. How dare you? You know, you fought against us that were out and denigrated us and spoke against us in public, but yet down the road you get to benefit from our fight. And that just burns me up. You know, I've been at parties where, yeah, I got spit in the face and told by a church person, because of fags like you, it makes it harder for people like us. And then damned if he didn't get married to his partner 30-some years. I mean, that just burns me up. Rod's always like, you've got to let it go. And I'm like, you know, gay people can be their own worst enemies.
Absolutely.
Can be their own worst enemies. So, what else, baby?
I think my last question that I have is, how would you like to still be involved in activism, and what would you love to do now to, like, be back in the scene? Or would you want to go back in the scene?
For the tape's benefit, the man is thinking. He is pondering. I'm in my 60s. My time has come and gone. It's up to the young people now to kick ass. People like me should be used as reference points by the young. Maybe we can steer them. Maybe we can help them not make the mistakes we made. Maybe we can tell them who to watch out for and be careful around. That'll, you know, might turn around and stab you down the road. We have experience. It's like an old hooker training a new one. You know, you've been around the block. My time has come and gone. I did my bit. I fought. You know, I don't have any regrets. I paid my dues. And I got the rewards. I reaped the rewards in the end. The marriage equality thing especially. I think back to when I had friends who had AIDS and they'd be in the hospital in Roanoke and the nurses and doctors wouldn't come in the room. They'd put the tray on the floor and kick it through the door to my friends. They wouldn't even come in the room. They put caution tape across the doorway. They made you wear this whole outfit and gloves to go in there. I mean, people with AIDS were treated like they had some bizarre disease from the moon. You know, kids nowadays don't realize that. I mean, there are now medicines and antivirals and things like that. Back then, there wasn't any of this. And I think kids should look to people like me and say, okay, you went through this, you saw it, so what should we try to do to make it better? You know, use people like me as reference points. You know, we might not be technologically savvy, but we've lived. Would I get re-involved in the movement? Probably not. But I'm old. I'm tired. You know, I'm cleaning toilets at 4:30 in the morning. Truly, when you're young is when you need to be kicking ass. When you've got the strength and the heart and you haven't been kicked a lot, that's when you go. That's when you don't have enough common sense to know what might be down the road. You've still got that boldness, that dream. You've got your dreams. I'd say the young people are the ones to move forward. The young people are the ones to fight for marriage equality protection. The young people need to realize that if they don't keep their damn eyes open, they're going to lose it. I mean, this is not an accepting society, and kids need to know that. I think a lot of gay youth take it for granted that they're going to have all these privileges when they get older. Uh-uh. They can be revoked in a heartbeat. That's a democracy. You can vote on it. And I just think, you know, young people need to keep their eyes open. They need to be on guard. You know, you never know. Marriage equality might be revoked. It could happen. People like me will probably be grandfathered in because we're already legally married and recognized. Young people won't have the opportunity. I really think young people need to keep their eyes open and watch out. And for straight women, I would say Roe versus Wade. Fight for that, because it's coming, and it's coming soon. I mean, if the way the Supreme Court is going, they're going to revoke Roe versus Wade in the next 5 years. And after they knock that down, it'll be marriage equality. That will be next, because the pendulum is swinging back to the right, and it's swinging hard. We have a president in the White House that has no balls because he can't. Because he has the Congress against him. Because he cannot find the votes. Because there is no more bipartisanship. You're either this way or that way. People don't work across the aisle anymore. America is a polarized society. You should see that with all the race problems that have now erupted. That we worked so hard to put behind us. My mother was a civil rights person. She was with Church Women United. She was fighting to integrate the churches in Roanoke. We used to get calls in the middle of the night to burn the house down. Daddy was petrified. I mean, but my mother was a quiet woman of faith, and she didn't back down. I was so proud at her funeral here at our white church. There's a whole row of old black ladies, and they had fought with Mama for civil rights and all, and they were so proud of Mama because she was one of the few white women that would go with them. And they showed up for her funeral, and I was so proud of them. I mean, it's never going to be easy. As long as we have morality in this country, they can beat us over the heads with it. You've just got to be strong, and you've just got to believe in your dreams.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This has been amazing. Honestly, I'm honored to talk to you, and we thank you for everything and all your words.
Yeah. I have no children. This will be the legacy I leave.
Well, I think you definitely have an amazing one to leave. So I'm excited to show this and have this around to people.
I'll be curious to see the outcome. They're either going to say, what a tired old queen, or they might actually say, he might have a point or two. So I do thank you for being a guest of my home. I'm very honored you drove an hour up to talk to me. And I hope to God, in all my ramblings, there's been something you can take with you that will be of use.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that was Tommy Fazell, and I'm so glad you came up here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.